Hello, I'm Priya Bates, President of Inner Strength Communication based in Toronto, Canada.
And I'm Adwita Patel, Director of Comms Rebel based in Manchester, UK.
And we're co-founders of A Leader Like Me.
We've also recently published a book with Kogan Page called Building a Culture of Inclusivity: Effective Internal Communication for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion.
In season three of our podcast, we will introduce you to diverse voices where we talk about the role of communication personally and professionally in building inclusive cultures.
We hope you enjoy our podcast. So today, Priya and I are very excited to welcome Matthew Burgess to our podcast. Matthew works for Work Networks, which we're going to ask him to just explain a little bit about what Work Networks is and what it does. It's based in the UK, so for some of our global listeners, it'll be a new organization, I think. So Matthew, correct me if I'm wrong. Is it a global? Is it a UK-based organization, Work
Yeah,
Networks?
we're based in the UK, but we work with organizations mainly in the UK, but actually our client base does stretch all over the world.
Amazing. So on that then, Matthew, would you be able to tell us a little bit more about you personally? Who are you? How did you get involved in Work Networks? And what does, it's going to be a very big question, but what does inclusion mean to you?
Wow, they said you three. There are three big questions that you've got there that you want about me and how I got involved with Work Networks, and what does inclusion mean to me? And so I think what inclusion means to me, I'm gonna let that one float, because
Okay, amazing.
it will come in, I think, to the other to the rest of our to, it'll pick up on threads in our conversation, I think. So how did I can let me tell you how I got here. Okay, so Work Networks is a workplace for a Meta partner. So we are a, actually one of the, I'd say one of the world's experts almost in deploying Workplace, which is Meta's work communication platform. I came here because I worked previously, I worked at Discovery, now Warner Brothers Discovery, a global media company. I've always had a very scattered work life, shall we say. I began my working life as a someone who played video games on television for a children's television program. So, the bar for job satisfaction was set very high then. And since then I've been a television producer, I've been a journalist. I was a DJ for 20 years, and then I ended up at Discovery. I've been at Discovery for quite a long time, and then Discovery implemented Workplace. They were one of the UK's first customers for Workplace, and I was leaning over someone's shoulder, being nosy, if there's anything that word that describes me, I think nosy is a good one. And I thought, oh, what's that? Let me get involved in that. And that was at the beginning of 2017, and it totally transformed my how I could connect with this organization at Discovery. Prior to that, I was connected with people in the UK and I was connected with people in my team. Suddenly, I was able to connect out across this huge global organization. And, one of the very first things that I did with this newfound kind of connective power, suddenly I realized that we've got people all over the world. And I started inviting myself into groups, the Southeast Asian Innovation Team, and, a bunch of people who were, interested in work culture who are based out of New York. And then we had a program land on our desks, which was had Idris Elba, who was kickboxing in Thailand, and on the gym that he was on the wall of the gym that he was training in, there was some graffiti in Sanskrit. We obviously needed to find out what this says. Now, it could say anything. It could be it could be something which is it could be something offensive. It could be something which is politically sensitive. We need to find out these things, especially nowadays when everything can be screenshotted and shared. And previously, we would have had to find a producer, a freelance producer who spoke Sanskrit and bring them in. But I just put a screenshot into Workplace, and within 10 minutes, someone from the Southeast Asia Innovation Team actually had got back to say, it just says put your water bottles in the recycling. And so it was almost that thing where it's just like, ah, suddenly I'm part of this big collection of people in a way, this big collection of brains. And that beginning of that year transformed my working life. So by the end of that year, I had won a Dragon's Den competition inside Discovery with the thing that went on to become Discovery's employee innovation campaign. I just sowed the seeds, by the way. There were a lot more people involved in making that a success. My colleague Stefan and Irene particularly. So that, and I created a guerrilla employee appreciation campaign called Appreciation Day, which was all done under the nose of anything, everyone official there. And basically got involved in the wider organization. I also ended up getting made redundant because I neglected my day job as a result of doing all these things. I got given the boot as a result of that. But what that did, I mean, you know, that makes it sound a bit more dramatic than it was. But what that did was it suddenly opened my eyes, I suppose, to the benefit of being connected to people and people who aren't just part of the work hierarchy, but people as people, and, you know, liberating, I suppose, the human voices and opinions and thoughts and ideas and, you know, the humans, I suppose, yeah, that are inside large organizations who otherwise you wouldn't see or know or get to experience at all. And so I think, you know, after that, I was fortunate enough to meet Nick. I was very long-winded here, Priya. I'm going to beat you in the long-winded stakes. And understand, actually, there are people who did this for a living. They work with varying organizations to do this. And so I managed to get Nick to employ me, within Work Networks. As I said, one of the UK's first workplace partners. And now what we do is we do this inside other organizations.
You know. Wow. That's great. It reminds me of when I worked for Compaq. So Compaq Computing. So I just aged ourselves, the people who know. Advita's like, who's Compaq? But you know, those who know, Compaq Computer was acquired by Hewlett Packard. And I worked for both organizations in the early 2000s when that happened. And prior to the acquisition by HP, Compaq had rebranded. And what their rebranding tagline was inspiration technology. And it was, and then the it was what people do with technology is what is inspiring, right? Mm. And that whole piece. So here you are working with a platform. Mm. You know, I know Advita and I've had this conversation, as I always say to IT professionals here in North America, it's not the field of dreams. Again, maybe aged myself with the field of dreams movie, because Advita's like, what's that movie? And I was like, you haven't seen the movie with Kevin Costner? You should see it. But the whole idea is the line from that movie was, if you build it, they will come. And I've seen so many organizations build it, build the technology, build the platform, and then wait. They flip on the switch. We see that with Microsoft 365. We see that with all of the platforms that have been introduced. And then they expect it to magically come to life without the work. So talk to me a little bit about your experience in terms of how do you bring people to those platforms, and how do you get them to inspire through those platforms and innovate?
You know, great question. And, you know, also someone else who also remembers Compaq, and worked with the UK's, press teams on Compaq, actually, back in the mid 90s. Anyway, there's a really great point about technology and the thing that technology is often almost implemented by tech teams whose job is to implement technology. And that's where it stops almost. And Workplace flips that, I think, because it's a people platform rather than the technological one in a way. And I think because it's built on technology that people use in their daily lives, you know, your WhatsApps and Instagrams and Facebooks and what have you, that actually the tech bit is just a tiny bit. And in fact, in a workplace launch, that just gets dealt with at the beginning. The main bit of making, workplace work is the people bits, the relationships, the leadership. You know, the comms teams, and you know, we work very closely with leadership and with comms, because you know, especially for comms, we really believe that comms is something which is a connective function that should be at the heart of every organization. You know, I remember, I'm old enough, I suppose, to remember the days when comms was broadcast. It was like the mouth of Sauron, in a way, just, you know, pumping out the messages inside an organization. But now it's totally different. The workplace really energizes, I suppose, comms teams to connect, to build relationships, to do that sometimes invisible work almost of smoothing the paths that make it possible for people all across an organization to say, yeah, I can contribute to this. I can weigh in on this discussion. My voice here matters. And I really think that leaders and comms team working together, what they do is that they create the conditions where this happens. If, you know, whenever we work with clients, I'm very fond of a gardening metaphor. And I think gardening metaphors work for the type of gardener that I am anyway, because you create the conditions where something happens, but you don't create the thing that happens, you know? And I think that that's what we try to do when we implement workplace. As I said, the technology is not really the focus. That, you know, we always say the platform isn't the purpose. The purpose is the possibilities almost, that new connections engender new possibilities. And yet they don't happen by themselves. You know, they need to be encouraged. They need to be nurtured. Give permission almost, or make it clear that, you know, we work with a housing organization, and it was their maintenance crews that started picking up on workplace quickly, because rather than writing big reports about how to describe a fault with a drain or something, they could start taking videos or images and sharing around that way. But it's creating the conditions where things can happen, where people can make connections or come up with solutions that they would do by themselves, you know. And we're a real firm believer in that people have the ingenuity, they have the capability, you know, they don't need fixing. You know, if I go back to my coaching days and bring that in, they just need the openness, I suppose, to yeah, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. And I think that's what we like to do. We empower the people who think I can do that.
In your opinion, Matthew, you know, how do you evoke that curiosity in individuals to ask those questions or put themselves out there a little bit? Because one of the bits of feedback that Priya and I get from other communication professionals when they're telling stories is that sometimes, especially in the world that we're in right now, there's a bit of a reluctance to share openly about some personal thoughts on certain things that are going on. So people hold themselves back. And we have noticed this, you know, from the clients that I work with, I know Priya works with, is that there is a bit of a reluctance to be your true self or your authentic self or bring your whole self, all those terms that people put out there, which don't work, to be honest. And that's a different conversation we can get into later. Mm-hmm. But how do you evoke that curiosity in individuals through the technology and the platform so they feel safe enough to ask those questions and put themselves out there? Do you have any techniques, or have you seen any organizations that you've worked with that have done this incredibly well, where they've encouraged this kind of safe, psychological safe space where people can put things on there without the fear of being blasted or told off or getting it wrong? You know, the fear of failure, right? That's what people struggle with.
Very, you know, that you answered a great question, and I answered it pretty much yourself in a way there, Advita, because, you know, it is about creating an atmosphere of safety. Mm-hmm. And this is where you know I think that sometimes it's a neglected part of DE&I initiatives. In a way, they seek to include, but sometimes make people feel fearful, because they, you know, the world is suffering right now from an epidemic of judgment, and people fear the instant judgment, and that there's no way back if they get something wrong. And so, of course, as you say, that's going to make people clam up and not feel free to be able to express themselves or to be able to start talking without knowing the right answer. Which is, again, is a death knell for any kind of people, you know, who want to build work together. So you're absolutely right. You have to make it safe. And you have to make it, you know, I can think of you know, a number of organizations, I think, who do this really well. And it starts with the leaders and the comms teams, in my experience, working together. That, you know, if I think about, we work with this, with All Three Media, who are a collection of, mainly television production companies, fantastic array of talent, you just wouldn't believe. And Sarah Gator, who's their COO, she is the one who brought us into All Three Media, and really started to drive the connections around D&I by focusing on, again, on conversations, on places where people could get together and start to talk and chat about their different experiences. And then suddenly from that, you said, oh, I never knew you worked here. I never knew you did that. But it took someone like Sarah, who's, you know, she's an extraordinary, extraordinary person, and a real, she's got this kind of like a big heart and a straight talkingness all kind of wrapped up in one. And using that energy, almost like it opens the door, it creates the conditions where these conversations can happen. You know, our amazing client, Royal United Hospitals Bath, Lucy, who's their head of comms there, she always says something that I will steal, which is that, you know, she says workplace is a place for the human voice and not the corporate voice. And I think that this is what great leaders do, is that they foster a culture where the human voice can come out and can come backwards and forwards. And, you know, if I think about another one of our clients, the Northeast Ambulance Service, where their chief executive, Helen Ray, is really front and center in engendering this conversational safety across the whole organization, you know, to the extent with which you could tell its success by the fact that they built such a safe space that their workforce now found that they had a safe space to, you know, rise up in rage sometimes against the leadership, and really, you know, take them to task almost, or to, you know, make their feelings known very clearly. But what's interesting about a safe space, and I think a safe space that is maintained by leaders and where leaders aren't afraid to apologize or to stand back and listen rather than to decree, is that, and this is what we're finding at Northeast Ambulance in the main, is that it maintains itself to a degree, and that sometimes the lines get crossed, but people will often pull themselves back by themselves without needing to be corrected or admonished. And again, you know, if you come back to this idea of the conditions, you're creating the conditions, you know, you're not telling your plants how to grow. You just know you're making sure they get enough light, enough nutrients, enough water. That's what you're doing. And that's what the leaders are doing. They're making sure that the community are getting them as a human being. They're getting truth, for want of a better word, from them in a human voice. And the comms team are working around the edges. You know, they are connecting with people one to one, saying, I think you crossed the line a little bit there. Really understand what you're trying to say. We're not going to be banning you or removing you, but I just, you know, understand how it would come across. And sometimes you get those little one-to-one conversations in the background would enable the understanding that kept that safe space going. And again, you know, really shout out to the work of the comms connectors, you know, the people who deploy conversations, you know, you as you two will around the outside, conversations that don't ever get recognized or heard, but they're really important for keeping the big conversation going.
Now, it's an interesting point. I know that when we were all launching social media policies in all of our respective organizations over the years, there was a lot of thought about what was around, what was allowed and what wasn't. What are the guidelines? Are you seeing when they're deploying internal technologies that same kind of process occurs, where there is some sort of starting point and some sort of education that happens in terms of who are we and how do we show up?
Yes, although I think that's done by example over time rather than by decree, should we say. There's a really interesting, in some way, the balance between grace and judgment defines these things. Okay. And I first came across this by this, this is going to be a slight curveball here, by a guy called John Zarl, who is an Episcopalian priest and a disco music DJ of quite some renown. And him and his family, they talk about this idea of judgment versus grace, and judgment being the law, the application of the law. And any kind of judgment is counterproductive because it produces its opposite. If you try and impose judgment or a law on things, then it produces a negation or a reaction against it. You bristle, don't you, sometimes when you're given a law to follow. But when you're given grace and when you're given the freedom to fail or to get things wrong, and you are in an environment where other people fail and get things wrong and, you know, don't know the right way of doing things, then that allows you to find your feet. Mm-hmm. And I think that we're in favor of the word guidelines, I think, rather than laws or policies, allowing people to find their own way, which I think people who work together in an organization with other people generally do want to, mm-hmm. Is, you know, sometimes it takes longer, but it gives you a richer community in the end.
Mm-hmm. I love the disco priest. What a great description. I love it.
Do you know, I think I learned so much about, I suppose, actually, diversity, equity and belonging and inclusion through nightclubbing and DJing. You know, I was fortunate enough to be part of a club in London for 20 years, and it changed my life, absolutely changed my life. And I was a DJ in this club. And so for many years, I was able to observe dance floors. You know, places where people would come and lose themselves in music, and what it was that made a great dance floor, you know, a place where people would feel safe to lose themselves. You know, to lose yourself in music is the most precious experience, and to do it with other people at the same time is just, you know, it's a real privilege to be part of. And you can't do that by decree.
No, and that is so powerful. And I think one of the things that we tend to lose, and this could be a bit controversial now, why not? One of the things that I noticed with technology, as great as it is, you know, and it does make the world a bit smaller in terms of connection. But in your opinion, you know, you just gave a beautiful analogy about dancing and how it brings people together and the human connection. What's your thoughts or opinions on technology when it comes to the art of conversation? And the reason I ask this question is because I recently did an interview with Korn Ferry, actually, where the interview was around how we just don't talk on the telephone anymore. You know, everything is a Teams or it's a workplace or it's a post. You know, we don't tend to have these conversations like human to human. Do you believe that's true? Do you think that's accurate? You know, you work with this space obviously quite frequently. Are we losing the art of conversation, or is the work that you do an enablement to bring conversation? And what are your thoughts on this kind of conversational stuff, human to human connection?
So there's two ways that I look at this, I think. First of all, whenever we work with workplace with any clients, I always make it clear that workplace is half the circle. You know, that technology is half the circle, and being able to interact in person, for want of a better word, is the other half of it, in a way, and how workplace works so well at Discovery, because you could connect with people who weren't in your immediate work environment, and yet when you did go into a work environment, into a meeting or, you know, a workshop or something, so you could carry on the conversations and the links you made out in the wider work world, or, you know, you might, have an in-person workshop or event and you post the pictures and all the chat and conversations on there, and other people who weren't at that event would pick up on it in a way. And so the two things kept the conversation going. And I think the conversation is not really so much about technology at all, really. That what it is about space and time. And I'm, you know, a real firm proponent in the idea that work, our work life, for want of a better word, is not about our work, and all about our work, the actual the nuts and bolts of targets or our productivity. In fact, making space for conversation away from work, or away from it having a transactional value or a goal that connects to the company, or that, you know, actually that you, to make time and space to connect as human beings, as we're doing now, I think, you know, that technology can liberate that in a way, but it's the human beings, I suppose, that make it possible. So technology sometimes interferes, doesn't it? It invades our life to such a degree that those private spaces that we might have had before, like our commutes, for example, or our coffee breaks, suddenly become, they're no longer our own. That we are now, you know, that we've got little devices that chirrup in our back pocket and bring our attention away from such things. And again, you know, it's easy to say, okay, you need to make sure you make time for away from those things. But this is, again, back to where leaders come in, that leaders need to make time, you know, I think there's a real need for leaders to act counterintuitively to do this. You know, I love it when leaders give the company a day off, or they act in a way which feels counter to their role, in order to say, no, right, you have to protect the time that you would have to make conversations, or I'm going to make it part of your job description that you turn your phone off, or something. You know, it's that kind of thing. And you know, it's a shame in some ways that what used to be normal and natural, you know, excuse those words almost, but just an instinctive part of our work life, that we have chats with people, now needs to be something that we build in time for. But it doesn't mean that it's not something that leaders should pay attention to.
Now let's talk a little bit about the echo chambers that we tend to find ourselves in when it comes to technology. When you're implementing a solution inside where it's natural for us to connect with the groups of like-minded departments, like-minded individuals, like-minded from a lifestyle perspective, how do we encourage that connection from that perspective, but also encourage people to talk with people who don't necessarily think like them?
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about work social networking, rather than your private social networking, is that you don't have a choice with everything at work. And I said that in the best possible way, in a way that, mm-hmm. you know, when in your own private social networking spaces, you can curate them exactly as you choose. So you can choose the extent of your echo chamber, and nothing else will get in unless an advertiser sends it there. And yet at work, you are, and you know, workplace is, you know, it gives its users a great amount of control, because, you know, it's not, the advertisers can't get into it. It's a private platform, but also gives the organization control. And so you can, you know, it's a real privilege for me, for example, being in so many workplaces, and, you know, working with organizations across the UK and the world, to see things like during Black History Month, for example, to be able to eavesdrop, although they obviously know I'm there, on local stories, you know, within Black History Month, for example, that I never would otherwise have come into contact with. Mm. And that these suddenly, I don't know, enrich your world in a way. And that the benefit, you know, that this, or side effect almost, of the fact that we are so used to consuming media in a very quick stream that we flick down by on our phone, is that actually we are attuned to picking the details of something up extremely quickly. So even if you skim past that post quickly, that it goes in, little bits of it go in. You know, I'm a firm believer almost in a way in scattering the seeds. And so even for the people who don't click into the piece and read it in depth, little bits of those things go in. And, you know, I always try to really, you know, encourage the DE&I teams that we work with, because sometimes they can feel disheartened if they haven't got a certain amount of actual responses sometimes to their posts. And, you know, I'm sure that you all know this, and, you know, Evita, at our event that we ran, you know, it was a common thing, wasn't it, for people to come together and feel like it's hard to speak into the void. It's hard, you know, even on some of your podcasts, you know, I'm hearing you say, where's the conversations? You know, I know that when we talk one-to-one, there's loads of, you know, interaction, but where are they? Where's the conversations? It's hard sometimes for DE&I teams to make this fantastic content and make it, you know, put their heart and souls into making it interesting and engaging, and not to see the results of that. But I really believe, and, you know, workplace, you can see who's viewed content and who's scrolled past it, that those things go in. And over time, that will build the edges, almost, that will push at the edges of someone's experience. And, you know, to an extent where things which may not have penetrated their personal world become normal in their working world. And again, you know, work is a big part of our life. And if we can pay some attention to that, making that work life a bit richer, or a bit easier, for want of a better word, a bit less of a pain in the ass, then that can filter back into your personal life. And, you know, hopefully just expand those bubbles out a little bit by a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, it all comes down to curiosity, doesn't it, Matthew, at the end of the day?
Yes.
And you have to be curious about other people to pay attention to what others are saying. And the reason I think a lot of people tend to switch off from EDI, DEI, whatever your kind of acronym is in your organization, is because they often forget to talk about the why behind it. And we had a really, an excellent conversation with a previous guest in one of our first seasons, Adina White, who shared with us that, you know, what in her experience as a Black woman from the southern states of America, she's recognized that what she's seen in her experience is that when something isn't about you in that demographic, the dominant culture, and then people don't pay attention. And I think as human beings, we can sometimes lose our curiosity of other people. You know, and why did they do this, and what did they mean, and what's their story, what's their narrative? And we seem to have lost that a little bit from being curious about each other. I think when you, like your nightclub example, when you have, you know, a common interest with somebody, you often forget a little bit about the demographics or the stereotypes or the bias that you may have formed about that individual, because you've got a commonality there. But to get to that commonality, you do need to be curious. And to your point, when you're on platforms and you're scrolling, because we live in a very, you know, like a very immediate society now, you want everything there and now. And if it's not 280 characters, or, you know, fewer than 280 characters, sorry, you kind of lose interest, and people just don't pay that much time anymore because there's so much content. You do have to pause, stop, and reflect and think, what is this person trying to tell me about their story? And what do I need to learn about that story? And it can be a lot of energy, because when we're busy and we make ourselves busy, it can take a bit of time, right? And I think we can often blame technology. Like I said to you before, has technology stopped the art of conversation? But I honestly think that we as human beings have just sadly have stopped being curious about each other. And we're fearful of asking curious questions.
Yes, I think you've really nailed that, Advita. And it's, you know, I think that curiosity, it feels to me like the key, in a way, to so many of what should make, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion being this kind of opening flower, in a way. We're fascinated by the subtle differences, aren't we? And, you know, the people who, I don't know, but the thing is, to be able to ask questions about those differences, as children do, in a way, feel as adults, you feel, am I allowed to ask this question? Sometimes am I, and, you know, I can, you know, speak to this from, you know, my own position of, you know, being a straight white male, and having a very narrow band of lived experience, for example, and just being very fortunate, I suppose, to have had friends from, you know, who were you know, let's say friends who are gay or from different races or from different cultures, and who are just, I don't know, very unbothered by my naive questions, or, but what's that like? And what was this like? You know, that, and I think, and one of our clients, I don't know which one it was, they had a wonderful DE&I series of events where it's just like, you can ask me, where people basically would say, you know, I am a nurse from Suriname. You can ask me anything you like. I would not, you know, almost there was a series of questions where people put themselves up as, I am this person. Come and ask me anything you like about any of my life experience. I'm not going to take offense at it. And I think there's a tentativeness sometimes in that thing of being, and that locks people inside ignorance to think, mm-hmm. hang on, there are these, sometimes people are different and I don't know how they're different to me, and I don't know how they're the same as me, and I don't know how to ask the questions that open their world up to me in a way. So that's why people sit sometimes in stuck place, and why others reinforce that thing of, you know, my way is the best way kind of thing. And you're right, that curiosity is the key to unlocking that, isn't it?
And I think people know when you're being genuine in your questions, right? So to your point, your friends who are unbothered by your curiosity, you know, in my experience, Priya and I both actually are very open for curious questions, and we have a very strict no judgment rule. I think it's really important, and the reason we have that rule is because we know that 99.9% of people are genuinely curious and not malicious, and I think it's the way people may ask those questions that makes it real. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong, and people have got their own lived experiences of certain questioning and all that, and that's absolutely fine. But genuinely, I believe that if you are interested in individuals, it comes across in your questioning. You know, you're not asking it based on the biases that you may have had. You're not being accusatory. You're not pointing fingers. You're not making assumptions. And if you go in with a genuine question about somebody's background or lived experience, most people can tell, we're all adults, right? And we can tell that it's a genuine question, and we're more than happy to answer it. But I think you hit the nail on the head there, where you said it's a fear that can sometimes hold us back, or our own assumptions and bias about that group of individuals that can stop us asking those questions. So we just carry on with our assumptions around that. Right, I've just seen the time, Matthew. God, we could talk about this all day.
You two are pretty good at this conversation.
So Matthew, before we end the conversation, do you have any final bits of advice or techniques or tips for those who may be listening, who may be struggling around starting a conversation around curiosity? You know, how have you kind of grown your network of these individuals that have giving you permission to ask these curious questions? You know, it's intentional. I know you said that you've been quite lucky, but in our experience, we know some of this will be intentional on your part to build a network of different people and demographics. So any advice from you?
I'm a fan. I mean, you know, curiosity is a really central, you know, central, almost it's like the thing which enables us as human beings to as a species to grow, if you want to, don't get too grandiose about it. And it feels such an innate characteristic in some ways that if it's not there, then something must have blocked it in a way. So I think what I'm a fan of is almost creating frameworks that allow your curiosity to have rein. Now, sometimes, you know, that you'll know that from the kind of the tyranny of the blank page thing, where if you just put someone out into a workplace group and say, right, you can ask me anything, a lot of people won't do that because they don't know by anything that the array of possibilities and the possibility of rights and wrongs and not knowing who's there and who's listening is so big that actually it shuts curiosity off. So I think that to create a framework almost whereby the conversations or the curiosity can start, and you know that there's, I think there's any number of those. There's any number of like interview. I mean, I think that things like Humans of New York is a classic one, isn't there? Which is a a reason for someone to go and be curious about other people. Yeah, I love, you know, I'm showing my age here because I loved Smash Hits magazine. And one of their things that they used to do was a thing called the biscuit tin, where they would pull out random questions for celebrities. Some of them were profound and some of them were random. But the act of opening the tin and pulling the questions out gave permission for that kind of curiosity to come out. And so if you can create a ritual or a framework, which is a leveler almost, which allows anyone to be able to ask these questions, because, hey, you've got a biscuit tin, and every month or every week, someone gets questions pulled out and the conversations start on that. Then again, that can be enough of a permission for people to think, ah, this person laughed when this question was asked. Therefore, when I see them in the corridor, I can say, you know, when you answered that question, I've always wanted to know this. And I think that's how you build again, we come back to the conditions, build the conditions where curiosity is safe.
And it's those safe spaces that we create where everyone feels that they belong and that they're included and that they're valued is such an opportunity. Thank you so much, Matthew. This is the first time I've met you. So I've really enjoyed this conversation and it really is, it's amazing how everything comes together as we start having these different conversations about diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, and then start having conversations about technology and AI and how things are changing, that there's this opportunity that it's not an either or conversation. It's how do we bring things together in order to drive the progress?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, last thing on safety, that building a safe, I think there's a real difference between being safe to do something and safe from something. And I think a safe space is not a place where you are safe from something, where you're safe from the feeling of discomfort or the feeling of challenge. A safe space is a place where you should feel safe to do something you couldn't otherwise do.
So I love that.
Yeah. And so it's more like I think if you build a safety net, you owe it to yourself to also build a tightrope.
Yeah. Amazing. What a brilliant statement to end on. We will share the details on how you can contact Matthew in our show notes. But where do you hang out, Matthew? People want to chat with you.
You can find us anywhere. If you type Work Networks into any number of search engines or platforms, you will find us. We are just undergoing a big website rebrand, etc. at the moment, so do bear with us. But you can find us on the web at worknetworks.co.uk. And as you probably will have gathered, we love to chat. our work is very much built on relationships and conversations, and not on like hard sells or anything like that. We like to say that we are your partner from launch to couldn't live without it. And so that's done by many, many conversations.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time, Matthew. We really enjoyed this conversation.
Likewise, it was a real privilege to get to, you know, hang out and to share conversations with both of you, and really hope we get to do it again.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to our A Leader Like Me podcast.
Find us on socials and at aleaderlikeme.com.
And please do read our new book, Building a Culture of Inclusivity, Effective Internal Communication for Diversity, Equity and Inclusion. You can buy our book from anywhere you buy your books online.
And a discount code for our listeners is available. Just use the code ALLME20 at www.koganpage.com.
And please do reach out for us for any internal communication, change management, and DEI communication training and support your organization needs.
We have keynotes, workshops, and consulting programs available. Email us at info@aleaderlikeme.com.